This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Reach 2013, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 14 and 15, 2013.
All right, well, welcome to the workshop on a vision for life. I have some questions. If you read the workshop description, there's some questions there that if you haven't asked yourself at least one of these questions, you probably will sometime in life. Why was I born? What does God want to result from my life? And when I reach the end of my life, will I be able to say that I've done what my Heavenly Father wanted me to do? You think about it, it's an amazing statement that Jesus made at the end of his life when he kind of said to the Father, I've done the things that you've sent me to do. And obviously he hadn't done everything. There were still blind people. There were still lepers. There were still people who weren't convinced that he was the Messiah at all. And yet he was able to say, I've done the work that you sent me to do. And to be able to get to the end of life and feel like, you know, I've done the things that God wanted me to do. And that isn't going to happen by accident. That's going to happen when we're intentional and we recognize what it is that God wants us to do, and we're able to discern what it is that God really wants us to do. And discovering some of the answers, or getting at least some indication of answers to some of these questions, can be helpful in having direction in life and being able to accomplish significant things in our lives and with our lives. Now, there are people, and we have people in the Bible who went through tremendous changes in life, and sometimes it almost seems like, from our perspective, that God is doing weird things, and he's getting us to do weird things. So you think about a man like Moses. He's born in a time where if you would have been a neighbor to Moses' parents, Amram and Jochebed, you probably would have said, you would have sat around your dinner table that evening and said, too bad for them. Like, we really feel sorry for them. You know, that boy is not going to survive. And you just would have known that his life was going to be very, very short. And you would have felt sorry for him being born where he was in the time he was being a boy. It was just lights out for him. And that was it. But God had a different plan. And then he winds up being raised by his mother. She gets paid to raise him, and there he is. So I don't know how old he was when he went to the palace. And then he gets into the palace, and I would guess that Moses got to, you know, maybe 12 or 13, and Moses could have said, this is pretty good. Like, out there are my cousins slaving away, and I'm here in the palace. I got all the good stuff. I have a bright future. I'm in the royal family. I know all the important people in the government. God spared me. This must be it. This must be what God's going to do with my life. And then one day he realizes, no, that's not it. And he runs off into the desert. And there he is over in the desert. And he gets married. He has some children. He's a shepherd. He's doing just fine there. And there are probably days out there taking care of the sheep that Moses is thinking, oh, it's a pretty good life. I'm doing all right. I don't understand what some of that other stuff was about, but now I know what God wanted to do with my life, and I'm just a shepherd here. I'll raise my family, and we'll be okay. As a matter of fact, he was enjoying it so much that when God came and said, I'm sending you back to Egypt to deliver the children of Israel, Moses' response was, we weren't really thinking of moving. And, you know, that's not on our schedule here. And so, you know, send somebody else. Because he was really pretty happy as a shepherd. And he wasn't going to be that deliverer that he thought 40 years earlier maybe he would be when he's trying to do something with the Hebrew people there and the Egyptian slave masters. Then Moses goes back, he delivers the children of Israel, takes them through this. And then we look at it afterwards and we say, well, yeah, Moses. And Moses asked God a question. When God showed up and told him what he was going to do and he said, I'm going to send you, Moses asked a significant question. He said to God, who am I that I should go and deliver the children of Israel? And if you would think that God would have said to him, who else? Like, what do you think your life was about so far? You're a Hebrew. You're going to go back there. The Israelite people are going to say, he's one of ours. You're going to walk into the palace. You know the royal family. You know the significant people in the government. You know how the government system works. You know the language. You've been trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. You know how to dialogue and talk to those people at their level. And you have wilderness experience. So who else would I send? So you would think that God would have gone through Moses' life story and kind of pointed out all the things he had done to get Moses ready for that job, but God didn't say any of that. What God said to him is, it's almost like God said, oh yeah, right, well, I'll be with you. And that's the significant thing. And you see in life, sometimes we look at skills and abilities, we look at all these things, when really the key thing is God with us, and are we doing the things that God is, are we involved in what God is doing, and have we teamed up with him? And if we're teamed up with him, we're going to be all right. Now, just as we get into talking about thinking about life and what really matters, we think about determining a destination and vision, having vision in life. Does vision really matter? Does it matter whether we have a vision in life or not? Is that really significant? So determining our destination, I am going to suggest to you, is important. Why am I doing what I'm doing? How will I live my life? And what might God want me to do? Now, we often get hung up on what and where. Those are the questions that we ask. So you kind of get toward the end of high school, and people start asking you, and it's partly us older people's fault, right? Because you start getting to close to the end of high school, and we start asking you, so what are you going to do when you get out of high school? What are you going to do next in your life? But in some ways, that really is the wrong question, because we ask what and where, and sometimes we just beg God, like, just show me, just tell me what to do. Just tell me where to go. So you walk back there in the gym, you look at all the different tables, you can walk back there and you say, God, I'm going to walk back there in the gym, and I want you to show me where you want me to go. I'm just going to look at those tables, and I want you to show me which of those ministries you want me to get involved in. I want you to show me what you want me to do. And God just, I think he just kind of says, well, those are the wrong questions. Because the questions the things that God is interested in is, why are you doing what you're doing, and how are you doing what you're doing? Why are you going to live the way you're going to live? Why are you going to do it? And how are you going to do it? And when you have an idea about why you're doing, when you know why you're going to do what you're going to do in life, and you know how you're going to go about doing it, God will bring the where and the what. Because sometimes the where and the what are not as significant as the why and the how. And God will give you lots of opportunities to go places and do specific things. And the reality is, it might not really matter that much to God which country you serve in. He needs people in a lot of different places. And so God does not have one staff position over there in that gym that you must discover what that's his will for you, and somehow you got to figure out what that is. And if you wind up going to the wrong place, boy, God's going to be really disappointed with you. He's just going to say, man, he shouldn't have gone there. She shouldn't have gone there. I really wanted he or she to go somewhere else, and now they went and blew it, and they go on over there. If we know why we're doing what we're doing, we know how we're going to do it. God needs people in a lot of different places, and the reassuring part about it is, I think he just enjoys watching us make choices, because it's one of the ways that we are created in the image of God. God has choice, and he's created us as creatures of choice. And so we get to choose. And so when God watches us make choices, he's kind of like, oh yeah, I like the way they're learning to do that, and that's pretty good. I do that, and I've given them the opportunity to choose. And so then we make a choice, and the reassuring thing is, God already knew what you were going to choose, so he's not surprised. He's not trying to scramble and put all the pieces together now, because now you went and made that decision. Now what's he supposed to do? He already knew you were going to decide that. So he's just, okay, there. Like, look, they made that choice. I knew they were going to do that. That's great. And he's on his way. And so are you. And everything's great. But we think we're going to mess God up, or we think, you know, we're going to get messed up because we make the wrong choice. And so we get real paranoid about doing the right thing. And we kind of think that out there's one job or one spouse, and we have to somehow find that person. And we just go through all kinds of torture. When I think God is just saying, man, relax. Like, know what your basic principles are and how you're going to make that decision, why you're going to, like, if you're looking for a spouse, why do you want a spouse? And how are you going to go about choosing a wife or a spouse or a husband? What are the important things that are important to you in making that choice? And then God's going to bring people across your path. And you know, all right, well, that could work and that could work. And there's just not one person out there that is the only person that you can marry. I just don't think it works that way. And so I just encourage you to take the pressure off of yourself. Don't put yourself in this bind where you have to discover, because God is a God who reveals himself. He's not a God who hides. And so he is not somehow hiding from you, leaving you in this smoke and mirrors trying to figure out what you're supposed to do and not giving you any direction. Sometimes we feel that way. But I guess my encouragement to you is to think about the why and the how, and God will bring the what and the where. And you can do any number of things and be in the will of God, and God will be pleased because of why you're doing what you're doing and how you're going about it, rather than knowing specifically what you must do. Let's talk a little bit about the search for meaning, because meaning really does make a difference. Finding something meaningful in life is a common objective. Sorry, that's not a little easier to read there, but Viktor Frankl was a Jewish doctor who in World War II was living in Austria, and he had the opportunity to immigrate to the United States, but his parents were elderly and they needed care, and he chose to stay in Austria and care for his elderly parents. Well, he and his parents both all got sent to the concentration camps. He cared for his father in the concentration camp until his father died. He basically just barely survived the concentration camp experience, but survived the war, was in the camps at the end of the war, was when the camps were liberated. And he has written a book called Man's Search for Meaning, and it's a worthwhile book to read. Viktor Frankl is not a Christian, but he has a lot to say about man's search for meaning, which really correlates with the Christian faith and our knowing that God has a purpose for our lives. He had this to say. I have a couple of quotes here from Viktor Frankl in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. He says, a statistical survey of 7,948 students at 48 colleges was conducted by social scientists from Johns Hopkins University. Their preliminary report is part of a two-year study sponsored by the National Institute of Mental Health. Asked what they considered very important to them now, 16% of the students checked making a lot of money. 78% said their first goal was finding a purpose and meaning for my life. I just think finding purpose and meaning for life is just one of the foundational things that we pursue. He also says this, no instinct tells him or a person what he has to do, and no tradition tells him what he ought to do. Sometimes he does not even know what he wishes to do. And this is a person who has what he calls an existential vacuum. They just don't feel any sense of meaning. So instead, he either wishes to do what other people do, which is conformism, or he does what other people tell him to do, which is totalitarianism. And a statistical survey recently revealed that among his European students, 25% showed a more or less marked degree of existential vacuum. Among my American students, it was not 25%, but 60%. The existential vacuum manifests itself mainly in a state of boredom. I would suggest to you that in our affluent societies in the West, boredom has become our biggest problem, because we just don't have anything that really seems like it's worth living for. We just don't have anything that really seems to have meaning, and we become bored with life. We've tried so many things, and it's almost like Solomon in the book of Ecclesiastes, who said, you know, I pursued wisdom, I did all this, I left myself have all the pleasures, and all of it is vanity, everything is nothing, it's all futile. And our societies have basically... The United States in the Declaration of Independence said basically we have three inalienable rights that are given to us by our Creator: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we've taken those, we've pursued those to the absurd. Life, where we just want to experience everything there is to experience. Liberty, where we want individualism, we want the freedom to decide and make our own choices. And the pursuit of happiness, we pursued just happiness and trying to find happiness to the point of where we've bored ourselves to death with trying to make ourselves happy, and none of it has really brought fulfillment and meaning. And it's not, and none of those three, or those three combined, are not an adequate reason for the basis for a society or for a life. And if we're going to pursue life, liberty, and happiness, and that's the extent of it, we're going to wind up in this existential vacuum in a state of boredom. Also, Viktor Frankl said, the more one forgets himself by giving himself to a cause to serve another person or to love, the more human he is and the more he actualizes himself. What is called self-actualization is not an attainable aim at all, for the simple reason that the more one would strive for it, the more he would miss it. In other words, self-actualization is possible only as a side effect of self-transcendence. So he's saying you only actually recognize your own significance by actually serving other people, forgetting about yourself, and focusing on the needs of other people. That is at the core of the Christian message when Jesus said, the person who wants to be the greatest among you must be your servant. And it's exactly what Jesus taught, in that you are actually going to find significance and have influence in life, not by pursuing your own goals and objectives and trying to become great yourself, but by being willing to serve others and find a cause in which you can make a difference in somebody else's life, and then you will find significance. Someone told me, a man who was relatively wealthy, told me a number of years ago, and I've always remembered what he said. He said, life has been very good to me, and we have done very well financially. But he said, one thing that I have learned is that a person can never make themselves happy with their own money. He said, you can make other people happy with your money, but you'll never make yourself happy with your own money. And that's a profound idea, that sometimes we look for things that we can accumulate, things that we can get that we think will bring us happiness, and the more we get, the more meaningless it becomes. The world is filled with middle-aged people who had high goals, they pursued them, they arrived, and they're absolutely disillusioned with life, and they wonder what in the world to do with the rest of their life or what they should do from here. I met a man on an airplane a couple years ago, and we were traveling, and I was flying from Thunder Bay to Toronto. And toward the end of the flight, we got to talking, and he was on his way to northwestern Alberta to the oil fields to work in the oil sands there, and got to talking to him about how that all works. And he was saying, well, he goes up there for 2 weeks, and then he comes home for 2 weeks, and so every 2 weeks he flies back and forth. And he said, while I'm up there, I can work 16 hours a day, and I make lots of money, and then I come home for 2 weeks, and then I go back. And so he said, I go up there basically every month for 2 weeks. And he's saying, in 1 2-week period, I can make from $12,000 to $14,000. So he said, I'm going to do that for 3 more years, and then I'm going to quit, and I'm going to have enough of money for the rest of my life. I'll never work another day in the rest of my life, for the rest of my life. So I said, well, that's interesting. So how old are you? And he said, well, he was right around 50. So I said, okay, so you're going to be 52 or 53 years old. You're going to have enough of money to live for the rest of your life. So what are you going to do with the rest of your life? And he said, well, I'm going to get on my motorcycle and ride around North America and chase women. So, well, I guess that's one way to spend the rest of your life. And so we talked a little more. And then after a while, he said to me, so what do you do in Sioux Lookout? And I said, well, I'm a pastor. And all of a sudden, it got real quiet. And I could almost see the wheels turning. Like, what all did I just say to this guy in the last 20 minutes or so? So he got quiet. And then everybody started sputtering around. He said, well, I certainly believe there's somebody up there. And he said, you know, there is a higher power. And he said, I know that. He's saying, I said, well, how do you know that? And he said, well, I used to be an alcoholic and on drugs, and I got into AA, and I know that I couldn't have got out of that by myself. And they told us we need to ask a higher power for help. And so I did. And I know that there's somebody up there that helped me out of that. And so, well, that's great, because there must be other guys up there in the oil field that are into alcohol and drugs, and you know that God helped you out, and so, you know, you can help them to know that God can help them too. And he said, yeah, that's true, there are a lot of guys up there like that. So then I was talking to him about some of the stuff I'm involved in overseas and that kind of thing, and we're just getting ready to get off the plane. And I said, you know what, like, everybody has a choice as to how they're going to live their life and what they're going to do with the remainder of the lifespan that we have. And I just want to live my life in a way that when my life is finished, there are going to be people in the world whose lives are better than they would have been if I hadn't lived my life the way I chose to live it. And he said, I think I know what you're trying to say. And I said, yeah, I think too you do. That's something that we have a choice to decide how we're going to live our life and what really is worthwhile spending the rest of your life doing. What do you want to do? You can ride around North America on a motorcycle if you want, and that's your choice, but is that really going to bring happiness? Is that really going to be significant? Is that that really going to make a difference in the world? Or what do you want to invest your life in? My family and I spent a year living in Haiti back in 1989, 1990, which I know to many of you is ancient history, but it was back there. And we have friends in Northwestern Ontario. There's a couple that my wife and I are friends with, and we've been friends with them for, we've been up north 35 years and learned to know them one of the first years we were up there. And he's a businessman, owns a business there, and has become a very wealthy person. But he's an agnostic, and he would say, we have many discussions about God, and he would say, well, you just can't know. You don't know if God exists or not. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. And he was saying, I can't believe in something that I can't touch or feel or scientifically test and prove, and so I just can't. He said, I know what you're saying. It's probably true. It could be true, but I can't deceive myself into kind of saying, yeah, that's true, when I can't physically know for sure. So his strategy is he gets involved enough in the church so that if he dies, and he said the problem is we won't know for sure until we die, and then it's too late. So his strategy is to get involved enough in the church that if he dies and God does exist, that he thinks he'll be okay, but not too much so that if he dies and God doesn't exist, he hasn't wasted a lot of time and money in something that isn't true. So that's sort of his strategy. And we've had a lot of conversations about it, and he's getting close to 90 years old now, and his son is a committed believer. And I keep telling his son, when your dad, and his son says, one of these days, my dad's going to have a problem that his money isn't going to fix, and then he's going to have to face life in a whole different way. And I said, well, when he gets to that point, I'd like to have one chance to have one conversation with him about eternity and about his soul. So when you know your dad is at the place that he's facing eternity, I'd just like to come and talk to him one more time about his soul. And I'd like to just have a chance to have that conversation when he's in that situation and he's really facing eternity. And I'm still hoping that God gives me that chance. I met him about a year and a half ago in a restaurant, and we got to talking. And when we were getting ready to leave, he said, Merle, you and I have been friends for how many decades? And he said, I just really have been blessed by our relationship and the way that you have encouraged me and just the conversations we've had. I always feel blessed when I go away from you. And he's saying, you know, we have to stand here and say, not too many years from now, probably one of us isn't going to be here anymore. And he says, probably going to be me. And I just want you to know before that happens that our relationship has been a blessing to me. So I'm just going to tuck that away. And I'm just still praying that God will give me that opportunity to talk to him before he passes away. But anyway, that's a side issue. After we came back from Haiti, this man said, I'd like to get together with you and just your family and my wife and I, and we just like to look at your pictures from Haiti and talk about Haiti. And he said, all right, we'll do that. He said, come out to my cottage and we'll have dinner out there and we'll talk about Haiti. He said, all right, sure, we'll come out there. And he said, I'll meet you out by the road because it's kind of hard to find my cottage. And so he met me out by the Trans-Canada Highway and we started going into his cottage. And it was good he did because there were a lot of little turns back, these gravel roads back to his cottage by the lake. And my problem started when I started following back those gravel roads because I was driving my not too new Escort station wagon, and he was driving his Jaguar. And so I'm just looking at his Jaguar and thinking, that's a real car. Like, that's not what I drive, you know. I wonder what it feels like to drive a Jaguar. That must be pretty good. And we got in there, I parked beside him, and kind of got out of my Escort wagon and looked in his Jaguar, you know, the wood graining and the leather seats and all that stuff. And I'm thinking, I wonder what he thinks of my Escort. Like, that's a, boy, you know, he's God. Like, that's the kind of car a person ought to have. Like, that's just pretty good. So we had been to their house, and I knew what his house was like, but this is the first time I'd been at his cottage. Well, his cottage was bigger and nicer than my house. And so I thought, wow, like, this is really good. You know, he's got this cottage, and it's just, this is amazing. And then he said, well, dinner's not quite ready yet, so I'll take you and the children out in my sailboat till dinner's ready. So we got, he had like this 40-foot sailboat, and so we went out in the sailboat, and we're going around the lake, and I'm like, this is living. He's got the Jaguar, the cottage, the sailboat, like, he's got it all. Like, this is great. We came back in, sat down, we're having dinner down on the dock by the lake, and we're having steak and baked potatoes, and before we started eating, he said, no, you know, after dinner, we're going to go up to the cottage and we'll talk about Haiti, but we have a jacuzzi here on the dock. So if like, if your children want to go in the jacuzzi while we go up there, they could do that. I'm thinking, no, he has a jacuzzi too. And so and I will confess to you that my steak and baked potatoes didn't taste very good because I was sitting there thinking, this guy's got it all. Like he's got the Jaguar, the cottage, the sailboat, the jacuzzi. And me, I've got nothing. I don't have anything. And I'll never have anything the way I'm living my life. It's not that I just don't have anything now. It's not even going to change. And I'm going to die with nothing. I'm going to spend the rest of my life with nothing, and this guy's got everything. And I started thinking, you know, I should have stayed back in Pennsylvania. I should have gone into business. Maybe I'd have a cottage in the mountains and a boat at the shore and a nice house, and I'd have something. And here I am, you know, I got nothing. I even have to go to somebody else's house to eat steak. And, you know, my life just isn't working at all. And I was feeling really sorry for myself. And so we went up to the cottage after, and we're talking about Haiti and that, and we're going through there. And about halfway through our conversation about Haiti, this guy turned to his wife and he said, you know what, Pat? We should have got more involved in the church, because he was saying, look at Moreau and his family and the things that they've done. And he said, we've never done anything for anybody. All we've done is we've traveled different places in the world, but we always go look at stuff and then we come home. We've never done anything for anybody. And the Lord spoke to me and said, you know what? You were down there crying in your steak and baked potatoes, feeling sorry for yourself. But really, when you stop and think about who ought to feel sorry for themselves, it's him. Because his whole life is centered around things that really have no significance and no meaning. And I'll tell you today, if I would get to the end of my life and all I traded 70 or 80 years of life for would be a Jaguar and a sailboat and a jacuzzi, it's not enough. It's not worth it. That's not what life is about. And there are plenty of people who chase those things, but that is not where significance is found. And I refuse to be drawn into a society's thinking that lures us into thinking that that's where it's at. Now, there are days when I look at the Jaguars and sailboats and jacuzzis and they look pretty good. I'll tell you that. But that's not where it's at. And don't get drawn into to that kind of thinking. But in the society we live in, we have to be intentional about staying out of that, or we get drawn into it. And the thing that happens is you get out of high school, well, people say, what are you going to do next? Well, you get a job, and then you get a job, and then you get married, and then you buy a house, and then you pay off your mortgage, and the next thing you know, you're 55 or 60, and it's done. And all you, what did you do? You graduated from school, you got married, you had some children, you paid off a house, and then it's over. And there are just things that are really significant in life that we have to discipline ourselves to step out of the treadmill that society puts us on. And there's nothing wrong with any of those things. And there are people who have done all those things and had a focus on Christ and his kingdom, and they've done it well and they've lived well. I'm not saying you shouldn't graduate from school. I'm not saying you shouldn't marry. I'm not saying you shouldn't buy a house. I'm not saying you shouldn't never have a mortgage. Don't misunderstand. We so quickly want to go to having a checklist in life saying you can do these things, but you can't do these things. And life just doesn't work that way. We have options. We have choices. But in the middle of all those choices, why are we doing what we're doing? Why are you buying a house? Why are you marrying? Why are you having the job you have? What is it producing for the kingdom of God? What is the significance in what you're doing? That is far more important than whether you have a mortgage or don't have one. It's far more important than whether you're somewhere overseas in missions or whether you're here in Lancaster working a job here in Lancaster. You can serve the kingdom of God anywhere. It's God is concerned about the hard issues and what's going on in our hearts. So we have to be intentional. So I want to talk to you about developing a personal mission statement, because companies have mission statements. Organizations have mission statements. One of the first things we want to know about a mission organization is, well, give me your mission statement. Let me see why are you doing what you're doing? What's your mission? What are you trying to do? And you may do that if you go to work for a company. You may look for their mission statement. What do they say? What's the reason for their existence? Why are they doing what they do? And you look for a mission statement. Well, I encourage you to have a personal mission statement. Why are you in existence? Why are you doing what you're doing? What's the purpose of your life? Were you just born because of biological results of what was going on, and you, so you wound up being in existence, and you were conceived, and you're born, and here you are, and it's no fault of anybody, but there you are, and now here you are, you're trying to figure out what to do with your life. That's not it at all. God was, you see, the Bible tells us in Psalm 139 that God formed us in our mother's womb. The mental image there of those words is a woman knitting a garment. God weaved you together. He put your personality, your skills, your gifts, your interests, your abilities, your personality. God brought your physical characteristics. God brought all that together. You see, we have our sovereign foundations, things that God chose for us. God chose your ethnicity. God chose your personality. God chose the timing of your birth. And God chose your gender. God's hand was in all of those things. And when you were born, God looked at the world scene, and he looked at you as that tiny little baby that was, well, even before you were born, but when you were born, your parents were excited about you. But God looked down on you in that moment, and God said, yes, it's a girl. And he was so excited because you were exactly what he wanted. And he knew that he had designed you specifically the way you are because of how you were going to bless the world in the time that you were born. And in the generation in which you were going to live, God just knew that he wanted you the way you are. And he directed that whole process to bring you about as you are. So, a personal mission statement. How do we go about writing a personal mission statement? Step one, schedule a block of time in a setting with few distractions. Get somewhere where you have some solitude, some quiet, some time alone. And then reflect and journal a response to some of these questions. Number one, how would I like other friends and family members to describe me? What kind of a person would I like to be? I had a friend one time who told me that her and her sisters, they all think their grandma is just, she is the ideal person. And she's so sweet. And she's just so caring and so loving and so gentle and so kind. And they just love her. She is just the ideal person. And they all want to be like their grandma when they're her age. But, you know, maybe in the meantime, it's a little bit harder. But we look at that and we say, what kind of a person, how do I want people to describe me? What kind of a person, how do I want other people to experience me? What kind of person do I want other people to realize or to recognize that I am? And let me tell you something here. We're talking about long-term here. There's short-term goals and there's long-term goals. We're talking about over a lifetime, what kind of a person do I want to become? Because we often overestimate what we can do in 5 days, and we underestimate what we can do in 5 years. Over a long period of time, you can make a significant amount of change. Think about it. You think back to a week ago and think, am I a different person than I was a week ago? Well, we're not sure. Did I change much in the last week? I don't know. You think back 5 years ago, and you think, well, yeah, I'm not like I was 5 years ago. God's changed some things in my life in that amount of time. And so over a long period of time, change can come. Secondly, what's the most significant contribution that I could possibly make to my world with the gifts that God has given me? Recognizing your spiritual gifts, your strengths, your personality characteristics that would give you strengths and gifts. Look at some of those. Be honest about those. Sometimes we work so hard on correcting our weaknesses that we fail to utilize our strengths. And I'm not saying we should ignore our weaknesses. We need to change and grow, and we need to improve, and we need to work on our weaknesses. But let's not do that at the expense of using our strengths. Thirdly, what character traits do I genuinely value and would like to see modeled in my life? You do that, some of that, by looking at other people and saying, what kind of a person do I want to be? One of the things that I will tell you right up front here, that I do not have, my spiritual gift is not serving. And I admire people who have the gift of serving. And I'll tell you something. I was here, and I was in one of the workshops, and somebody walked in, and the back seats were pretty much full, and I saw somebody getting up. I just out of the corner of my eye, I saw somebody getting up and getting a chair for this lady who walked in. And the first thought that went through my mind was, that was Verlin Yoder. That was Verlin Yoder. He's a server. I know him, and I know that he's, and I knew he was in that room, and immediately, and I looked, and it was, because he's a person who immediately sees the needs of other people, and I want to be more like that. I want to be able to see the needs of other people and respond to those needs. And before I even thought about getting up and getting a chair, Verlin was already there with the chair, and because that's, if you know Verlin, you know that's the kind of person he is. And so you look at those things and say, what kind of a person do I want to be, and how, what values and character traits do I want to have modeled in my life? And then who have been role models in my life, and why do they inspire me? What elements of their lives do I want to see in my own life? How do I want to grow and change? Who are people that I admire and look up to and say, there's somebody I'd like to be like. There's somebody that has some characteristics that I'd like to see built into my life. In the next 3 to 5 years, in what ways would I hope to mature in my relationship with God, with my family, with friends, work associates, and community? What are things that I could grow in? What will be the center of my life? Who or what am I going to live for? What are the most important things in my life? What will be the character of my life? What kind of a person will I be? What character qualities will describe me? What will be the contribution of my life? And who do I have the most desire to help? Are you drawn to ministry to children or to mothers or to some ethnic group or whatever it is? But what interests, where do your desires direct you? And what might God want to do with your life? I think it's good to just reflect and open your life before God and say, like, what contribution could I make to the kingdom? What could I possibly do? What could you do with a person like me, and how can I be used in your kingdom? What will be the communication of my life? How will I share from my life to others? How might that happen? What are ways that I could benefit other people? What are the ways that I have? Is it physically serving? Is it encouragement? Is it financial giving? Is it being physically present with people who are suffering? Is it, just go through some of the ranges of thinking. How might God communicate his grace and what he wants to do in the world through my life? And then you take those things and you write a 4 to 8 sentence summary of your response to those questions. And then you take that summary and you edit it into a personal mission statement. And your mission statement should be like 4 to 6 sentences, something that you could work on for the next 10 years and not be finished with it. It's not measurable. It's not specific. It's not saying, I'm going to, do this specific thing in this time frame. That's not that's what you're looking for in a mission statement. Those are goals. Goals are measurable. Goals are specific. But it's the big idea. It's the grand vision. What might God want to do with my life? What might be the central ideas in my life? And I'm going to give you my personal mission statement here just for your information. This is what I have as my personal mission statement. My mission is to grow in my enjoyment of God, my respect for God, and my experience of his lordship in my life. You see, I have a need to grow in just respecting God and really honoring him and being a man that recognizes who he is and that I have that his lordship in my life, and that I really enjoy him, that I enjoy my relationship with him. That is something that I get a lot of pleasure from. And then I desire to nurture, provide support for my wife and my children. That's my first priority. I will give confident leadership, utilizing both wisdom and compassion to those for whom God has given me responsibility. I'll work diligently to make others successful and will freely use my gifts to do so. I will develop reserves of wisdom, spiritual strength, understanding, and love that will bless others and be useful to them. I want my life to be about more than just what I need for spiritual survival. What motivates me is to be able to be an encouragement to other people and to be able to have enough of spiritual resources that I have something to give to those who are struggling, to those who are facing challenges in life, to those who are looking for direction, for guidance, for insight, so that I can walk with them and be with them. Now, there are some people who have gifts of evangelism, and they go out and they love to confront people that are definitely on the wrong path and they're headed the wrong direction, and they love to just turn those guys around. And like Jay was, Irvin Fox was saying last night, you know, get those guys off the broad road and get them over here on the narrow road. And Alan Miller is one of those guys. He just, you know, when he was in Kenora doing prison ministry, he just loved getting into the prison and dealing with those guys that were antagonistic toward Christianity and all that. And he just, you know, he'd have people coming to the Lord. And I'm sort of, you know, if I get to talking to somebody and they're really antagonistic toward Christianity and all that, I'm kind of like, well, go ahead, enjoy yourself. And if you ever get tired of the way you're living, let me know. I'll try and help you. But, you know, it's, I'm not. So I had a guy at our church. We do a meal for the street people every Sunday afternoon. So this one day we're sitting there, and these street people are there. I'm sitting next to this guy talking to him, and so he's eating his dinner there, and we're having a little conversation. And after a while, he turned to me and he said, "This is a church, right?" And yeah, and he said, "I said yeah." And he said, "Well, what kind of church is this?" And I said, "It's a Mennonite church." And he said, "Oh, really?" And so he looked at me and he said, "Are you a Mennonite?" And I said, "Yeah, I am." And he said, "Oh man, I hate Mennonites." And I said, "Well, you can eat the food anyway. We share our food with people that hate us, so you go ahead and do that. So you don't have to like me to eat the food." But you know, I didn't feel. And I asked him why he hated Mennonites, and he explained it to me. But I didn't feel like getting into a big argument with him about, you know, if he wants to hate me, that's okay with me. But then you give me somebody, so I don't get very motivated by that. But you give me somebody who kind of has made a commitment to Christ, but they got a whole mess in their life. Man, I'll get in beside somebody like that, and I'll work with them. I'll give them my heart. I'll really pitch in and try to walk with them through the whole mess they got to go through to get to where they ought to be, because that's what I get motivated about, and that comes out in my mission statement. I want to have those reserves of things in my life, spiritual things in my life that I can use to help others. So last week I was in Haiti, and one of the Haitian pastors down there, we got to talking about his church and things that were going on in his church, and he was saying, "Man, I'm just really struggling." We talked about it, and I prayed for him, and then he was saying, "I just feel really alone. Like, I just really feel like I'm out here, you know, I don't have anybody with me." And he was saying, "Like, could I call you, and could we talk? Could you just help me here and give me some encouragement?" Yeah, I'd love to do that. And you see, when we kind of know where our gifts are, and we kind of know what motivates us and how God might use us, then he's going to bring the specific opportunities our way. And so we just live life, and here comes another opportunity. Yeah, that fits with what I like. That fits with what God's called me to do. I'll do that. And in the end, we wind up doing stuff that we would have never guessed that we would do, because God gives us opportunities to do. And when we're faithful, then, because God tests us. He tests us in areas of integrity. He tests us in areas of faithfulness. And when we pass those tests, then God starts bringing us opportunities. And the person that's faithful with little is faithful with much. And you see, sometimes we look at life and we want to do the big things. We say, "Man, I want to do something really big for God. I want to do great things." But the secret of greatness is not the pursuit of greatness, but the pursuit of faithfulness. And when you pursue faithfulness and you are committed to being faithful, God may bring greatness, but it's going to come as a byproduct of faithfulness, not as something you pursue in and of itself. And when you're willing to do the little things and do them well, God will give you bigger things to do. And I would guess if you could go back and talk to D.L. Moody and George Mueller and Hudson Taylor and some of the people that we look at as spiritual giants from the past, and you would ask them how they came to be a spiritual giant, they wouldn't know. All they would know is that every day they faithfully got up and served the Lord, and in the process of faithfulness, God made them into a man who was a hero that we consider to be a hero of the faith. And I just encourage you to pursue faithfulness and to look at how that can happen. Then we need goals. We need the specific. We need the measurable. What are your long-term goals? Do you want to be in missions? Do you want to be a person who is an encourager, a supporter of missions? What about your local church, and how can you support and encourage them? What are your long-term goals? Long-term goals are usually 1 to 5 years that you look at 1 to 5 years and say, "Here's something that I could possibly do in the next 5 years." We often overestimate what we can do in 1 week and underestimate what we can do in a year. Goals should be specific. They should be timed and they should be measurable. And then there's short-term goals, looking at the short-term, their weekly or monthly goals. Let me just get some things up here. Create a worry list. From your worry list, create a to-do list. From your to-do list, create short-term goals and evaluate your short-term goals and let your long-term goals and your mission statement and add what's needed to move you toward your long-term goals and your mission statement. One of the things that I've done for a number of years is to have a day of quietness before the Lord, and part of that day of quietness is to get an evaluation from God of my life and lay my schedule before Him, my calendar. What does God want to add to my calendar? What does He want to take off? And then also just to look at my life and where I'm at. One of the things I do as part of that also is to create a worry list. And you say, well, I don't need a worry list. I have lots of things I worry about. I don't have to list them. But you do, because the things you worry about drain your energy. So if you take an hour or 30 minutes and you make a worry list and you just write down all the things that you worry about when you're taking a shower or driving or you're doing something you don't have to think about, you can think about other things. But often those things that you worry about, they come into your mind when you're doing something else and you can't do anything about it anyway. So you create a worry list of all the things you worry about, and then you go back over your worry list and you ask a question, can I do something about this? And if you can do something about it, you make a goal. What am I going to do in the next month to begin to see this brought to resolution? If you can't do anything about it, then you commit it to the Lord and ask Him to do something with it. And at the end of your worry list, you have a to-do list because you have the things you can do something about. You decide in the next month what can you do about those things, and you evaluate, and you add other things to your to-do list too that you don't worry about, but you wind up with a list of things that you can do. We're just going to... you have to avoid distractions, the tyranny of the urgent. Not every need is a call. You're not called to do everything in the world. Stay focused. Don't be distracted by the success of others. Don't chase the latest sensational thing. Make a plan and work your plan. Don't be distracted by opposition. If you're doing something really significant, you'll have opposition because the devil doesn't want you to be successful. And so one of the things that's encouraging when you face opposition is you're probably starting to make a difference. And because you're getting criticism or you're getting, I'm not telling you to ignore advice and direction, but opposition can be an indication that you're on the right track. And don't be distracted by success. Don't get to the place where you feel like, yeah, I'm pretty good, I can do this. And don't get distracted by success. So know why you were born. Know what it is you can do that no one else can do in the same way. You are a unique person, and God brought you into the world because He wanted what you can offer to the world in this generation, and know what that is and what you can do. Seek God's direction for the mission statement in your life. Set goals and pursue them, and be faithful in the little things, and God will do great things. You see, I had no clue what God was going to do with my life. I had plans. I had ideas, things that I thought I was going to do. When I was 25 years old, if you would have told me that when I'm 59, I'd still be in Northwestern Ontario and I'd be involved in the things I'm involved in overseas and that I'd be the assistant pastor at a Beachy Amish church, I would have laughed at you. I'd have told you, absolutely not, man. I got plans for life and that's not it. But over years, God had a way of just gradually getting me to where I got to the point where I realized, you know, what I'm doing is more significant than anything else I could do in life, and this is it, and this is what I'm going to invest my life in. And today, I don't know what all God's doing. I'm just kind of there. I'm enjoying the things that God's brought for me to do in life, and I'm just blessed. And I just encourage you to just put yourself at God's disposal. Let Him use you. See what He brings into your life. You see, we seek adventure. We do all the extreme sports, bull riding and skiing and all that stuff, you know, we do snowboarding and we do it all because you go off the edge of that cliff on a piece of plywood and you think, man, I could die here. And then you get down to the bottom. Oh, that was great. Let's go do it again. And I want to tell you something. When you really put your life in the hands of God, it's an adventure. Because sometimes you're going with God and He's doing stuff and you're like, well, I could die. And you're like, yeah, and then you get done with it. Oh, that was great. You know, God, let's go do something else. And that's, you see, the problem that we have in Western society is that we are experiencing pseudo thrills because we're pursuing pseudo adventure. And the true adventure comes in putting your life in God's hands and letting Him do with you what He wants to do. It's out of your control. And that is true adventure, because when you're doing something that has significance for the kingdom of God, that is real adventure, and that brings a thrill that you'll never get through the pseudo-adventures and the pseudo-thrills that we often pursue in life. Well, may God bless you in your pursuit of His vision for your life. You're dismissed.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders Educational Programs. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.